You're listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Exactly 1 year from today, the UK will officially quit the EU. But what do we know so far, and what happens next? Today's podcast features Julian Jessop, head of the IEA's Brexit Unit, and Shankar Singham, director of the IEA's new International Trade and Competition Unit. Interviewed by Digital Officer Madeline Grant, the pair discuss some of the most pressing questions around Brexit, including what, if anything, the UK has managed to negotiate so far, how the economy has fared until now, the future of the Irish border, and whether there's any chance of Brexit being overturned. If you like what you hear, subscribe to our iTunes channel, IEA Conversations.
May the 29th, 2019 is the date that Britain will officially exit the EU. And 1 year away from our departure, I want to find out, what have we accomplished to this date? Julian.
Well, so far we have made some significant progress on some of the key issues that need to be decided before we leave. So that includes in particular citizens' rights, the financial settlement, the so-called divorce bill, and also some progress on the Northern Ireland border questions, though clearly the final answers there haven't yet been produced. So we have enough to start negotiating the terms of our withdrawal. A withdrawal agreement basically needs to be settled by October this year if the various national parliaments are going to have time to vote on this. The withdrawal agreement is about our departure. It's not about the future relationship, though it probably will include some sort of framework for future cooperation, including the bare bones of a trade deal. But it will still be some time, I think, before we have a trade deal in place, and that's why the transition period is so important thereafter. Alongside confirmation of a time-limited transition period, the other thing that's cheered me up is confirmation that we are definitely leaving the or a customs union with the EU. I think that's essential. There are potentially some advantages remaining within some form of customs union. I mean, it does guarantee tariff-free trade, and it's a partial solution, though not a complete one, to the Northern Ireland border problems. But it also brings many costs. Most obviously, of course, it would mean that we couldn't regain independence on trade policy. So it would make, you know, one of the big benefits of Brexit redundant, because we'd have to continue to do whatever the rest of Europe decided. So I think that's too big a cost for those partial benefits, particularly as those benefits could still be achieved in other ways. If we do get a good comprehensive free trade agreement with the rest of the EU, with new customs arrangements, then, you know, any increase in tariff and non-tariff barriers will be small anyway. What's more, if you remain within a customs union, it's not just a question of having no tariffs. You also have to accept many of the non-tariff restrictions. In particular, goods still have to meet many of the regulations that are part of the single market. So although, strictly speaking, the single market and the customs union are separate, in fact, there's quite a lot of overlap between the two. So if we remain within a customs union, I think we remain at least partially within the single market in terms of the regulatory burden. And in that sense, we won't have left the EU at all.
Yeah, this last point, actually, that Julie made is incredibly important. There is a tendency to think of these as two separate things. If the goal of staying in the customs union is to ensure we have free circulation, we continue to have free circulation, and that seems to be the goal of those people who suggested it, that does not mean you can be in the customs union and have your own regulatory system. You can't, because you will have to accept the rules of the EEA and the single market. Being in the customs union means automatically, if indeed you want to have free circulation, it means automatically that you must remain within the single market as well. And that means that if you are a service provider, which we are, we're the second biggest exporter of services in the world, and you can't put your domestic regulation on the table in a trade negotiation, you can't really have a trade negotiation. No one will take you seriously. So being in the customs union means being in the single market. Being in both means no trade policy, no external trade policy. And there will be costs, even in that situation, because we will not have the same authority over the direction of travel of European regulation. We will not be able to slow down anti-competitive European regulation. So there will be costs. The difference is that there won't be any benefits. The other thing that we are doing right now is we are negotiating our agricultural import quotas and our schedules in the WTO. And this is something that sort of doesn't really hit the headlines very much, but it is actually incredibly important, because one of the things the UK will be doing is retaking its sort of full WTO chair as an independent sovereign trading nation as of the date that we leave the European Union. So we have to ensure that our schedules have been placed before the World Trade Organization. And we have to do things like make sure we accede to the government procurement agreement and other sort of major agreements before we actually leave the EU.
From what you've seen so far, are we well prepared for that transition? Are we on track when it comes to things like the WTO?
Well, in terms of the agricultural import quotas, the so-called TRQs, there are a handful of countries, the big agricultural producer countries, that are very anxious to have, to make sure that they don't lose access into either the UK or the EU27 as a result of the UK leaving. And there is a negotiation on that point. Our position, the UK government's position, is that this is a technical rectification at the moment. That means that all we're doing is we're trying to replicate the schedules that we have through the EU. Now, what we've got to be able to do, and this is the critical piece of this, is we have to be able to negotiate with other countries. We have to be able to tell them that while we're replicating these schedules, we are willing to liberalise more in the future, and that the future is quite close. They have to believe that we are able to do that. If they don't believe it, then they're going to want to have as much access as they can get in this rectification process. And so it's very important. The WTO piece of this is very important because you build your entire trade policy in terms of agreements with other countries and so on. You build it on the TRQ negotiation and on the WTO negotiation. So while it doesn't hit the headlines very much, it is an incredibly important part of this process.
Yes, I think that's true. I mean, it really doesn't hit the headlines very much. Obviously, the news cycle seems to be entirely focused on how the negotiations are going day to day, and that's quite understandable. But do you think that we're also failing to have that kind of long-termist view of what Brexit could look like after we leave and the kind of the really broad agenda? Yeah.
One of the things that I think does need to change is we have a tendency to look at the UK-EU relationship on one hand, and on the other hand, it's sort of the rest of the world. Whereas actually what we are doing is we are moving towards being an independent trading nation with an independent trade policy. And that independent trade policy includes things that we will do ourselves, by ourselves. So we will be able to reduce tariffs in certain areas where we can. Once we have control of our tariff schedules, that's why it's so important that we have control of our tariff schedules. We have to be able to do deals with other countries bilaterally. And here, the agreement with the EU is one bilateral agreement. It's a very important bilateral agreement, but it's one bilateral agreement. We also want to do an agreement with the US and with others. And then plurilaterally, we want to accede to things like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, these sorts of things. The fastest growth region of the world is Asia, and the UK needs to face Asia more and take advantage of that growth. The TPP is also one of the most liberalising platform agreements in the world. And then in the WTO, we also want to be able, once the implementation period starts, we want to be able to speak to WTO groups. We want to join groups like the Plurilateral Group on E-commerce. We want to be a significant WTO player as quickly as we possibly can be. If we do that, then we're going to be able to move the WTO agenda in a more liberalising fashion. And that's frankly what other WTO countries expect, because we are the second biggest exporter of services and we are a major foreign investor. They expect us to play that role.
So come March 29th, 2019, will our relationship with the EU look so radically different? What will change in a really substantive way at that point?
Well, arguably, in fact, not a lot does change. I know we're all being trained to call this a transition period or an implementation period, but what's actually happening is essentially a standstill between March 2019 and the end of 2020, where very little changes. We remain bound by most of the obligations of the single market and the customs union. Of course, we'll continue to be paying into the EU budget as part of the financial settlement. So if you're looking at the Brexit project as about taking back control of borders, of laws, of money, then in a sense, this is Brexit in name only. I guess there are two things that are changing. One is that we're losing some of the rights of EU membership because we're no longer a full member. We don't have as much say as we would otherwise have done. But we are starting to take back control of trade policy, which is where Shankar's work is so important. Obviously, we won't be able to implement our own independent trade policy until after we leave the customs union in 2021. But we will at least be able to negotiate and sign agreements to come into force when we are finally completely free of the shackles of the EU's customs union. So that is another reason why trade policy is so important. I mean, that is very much something we'll start taking control of the moment we leave in March 2019, whereas other aspects are largely on hold.
So the timetable isn't quite as brutal, I think, as people think it is. There is this expectation that we need to have everything kind of done and dusted by 2019, when in fact rather looser timescales than general consensus.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lively debate, of course, about whether a transition period is necessary. I think actually we could probably get away without one, but if we are having the opportunity to prepare a little bit longer for leaving the EU proper, then I think why not take that opportunity? Some people say it's simply kicking the can further down the road. I think that's unfair. I mean, it does mean that we've got, you know, close to 3 years to fix all of the various technical problems, the practical issues that still need to be resolved, all the new agreements that we need to do, in some cases to replicate existing relationships we have with the EU or third countries, in other cases to start completely new work with the rest of the world. So I think a transition period is helpful to get over those hurdles. But for me, it's absolutely essential it's explicitly time limited. Some people have been spinning this as a defeat or a disappointment for the government, the fact that we're leaving for sure at the end of December 2020. I think that's wrong, partly because having an explicit deadline focuses the mind, but also because if there is a possibility of constantly rolling over that deadline, then there's clearly a risk that we never actually leave at all, that, you know, excuses are found for us to remain in. So I think it's essential that we do officially leave the EU in March 2019 and we have an explicitly time-limited transition or implementation period thereafter, so we know for sure where we'll be in 3 or 4 years down the line.
One thing that is going to have to change, frankly, really now, even before we hit the implementation period, is our negotiating posture, I think, has to change. We have to start thinking of an integrated trade policy which includes the EU agreement but also includes other things. We have to understand that all the benefits of Brexit come from the ability to benefit from these other agreements, benefit from the WTO process, benefit from unilateral, improving our own domestic regulatory environment and our tariff position unilaterally, and that those benefits have to offset the trade costs that will come with leaving the customs union and the single market, the trade costs of divergence if there is divergent regulation which isn't recognised, and the costs of moving from a free circulation system to a normal sort of trading relationship. Those costs are actually relatively small compared with the benefits of an actual liberalising trade agenda with countries like the US, with the Trans-Pacific Partnership countries, for example. The critical thing is that we are negotiating with the EU at about the same time as we will be negotiating with all these other players. And that's a good thing, because that will enable us to read across those negotiations and to be able to get a better deal with the European Union. All of these things are intricately connected, and it will enable us to get a better deal with the others as well if we play our cards right. So sequencing here is incredibly important. If we sequence this as doing the deal with the EU and then thinking about what we're going to do with other people, we are in for a bad result. It is critical that these things are run concurrently, and it's critical that other countries actually look at this period. Julian mentioned the dangers of kicking the can down the road and this never actually ending. You know, we have to understand that a lot of other countries look at us in this period and are sceptical about whether we in fact are going to leave in December 2020. So we've got to be able to convince them that not only are we going to leave on this date, but that our negotiations with them are serious and real, and that we can offer this liberalisation and we can do the things that we're going to commit to in these agreements with them very quickly in the short term. Nobody objects to the fact that you have a period of a year or year and a half or whatever to get your customs system in order to deal with the implementation issues that of necessity come out of leaving the EU. But if they think this is a stalling of the process, if they think that in fact we're going to take our foot off the accelerator and use this as an excuse to sort of pause, and this is both for the government and the private sector, then I think they're going to be sceptical about committing to negotiate with us. So we did get one very important thing in the withdrawal agreement draft that relates to the implementation period, which is a commitment from the EU that we will be able to negotiate, sign and ratify deals in that period. This is very important language because anyone can negotiate, but signing and ratification is a whole different. All the major issues that are dealt with in a trade deal are dealt with at the end. So anyone can start negotiating, but few people can actually sign. So that is good. On the other hand, the duty of sincere cooperation and common commercial policy apply in this period. And we have to be alive to the fact that the EU will, on the other side of the table, seek to use those to prevent us from doing the things that we need to do in order to convince other countries we're a real trading partner. And we have to be robust in our negotiation approach. There has been a tendency so far to think that the UK and the EU are both collaboratively trying to figure out a solution to a problem that the UK electorate has given us both as a result of the referendum. I think that's the way our mindset has sort of been in the negotiations. We have to move away from that, and we have to recognise that the EU is on the other side of the table. We want a good deal. We have lots of mutual benefit, and you know, we are partners. But they are on the other side of the table in a trade negotiation, and they don't have our best interests always at heart. And we should not be consulting them to determine what our trade policy should be. We should be executing our trade policy and trying to get the best deal we can with them.
I think many people would argue that precisely because of those reasons that you've described, one real concern is seemingly the lack of contingency planning for a no-deal scenario. If Britain isn't preparing for it as thoroughly as they might, it could either mean that we're unprepared if it does pan out that way, and it could also send out a very dangerous signal to those that we're currently negotiating with and reducing our leverage. Do you think that we're currently giving that the weight it deserves?
I think there has been increased focus on contingency planning for the eventuality that there isn't any kind of deal. No free trade agreement is possible, of course. One of the things that we can't control is the EU response to our proposals. And as long as we are making proposals, and as long as we are making reasonable proposals with evidence as to why the EU should accept these, and that we're doing all the things that one would normally do in a trade negotiation with the EU, which is, you know, working with member states and so forth, using the leverage of other countries that we're negotiating with. The one thing we can't control, even if we do all of those things right, is the EU response. And if the EU responds in a negative way, it's possible there won't be a trade deal. Now, I think based on that, we are readying customs. There are processes in place. I do think they need to be accelerated. There's a lot we can do on customs, for example, that will, frankly, the sorts of things that we could do even if we weren't leaving the European Union. Things like ensuring we have self-assessment programs, you know, really making sure our authorized economic operator program and our trusted trader program work better than they currently do. There's a lot of things that the Union Customs Code allows us to do, and actually a lot of other member states do them, frankly, a little bit better than we do. The Dutch in particular have a very effective customs operation. And we need to be doing that in order to be ready for this. And we need to also be considering, what are the regulations? If there is no free trade agreement, what are the regulations that we might want to move away from?
Yes.
How do we get pro-competitive regulation in the UK?
Julian, I want to ask you about how Britain's economy has performed since our vote to leave the EU. The assessment at the time of the referendum vote were kind of wildly pessimistic, and things seem to have panned out rather differently to that.
Yes, when the British economy has continued to grow at a fairly steady pace. This is, of course, in contrast to the forecasts of a sharp downturn, maybe even an outright recession from the Treasury and indeed many independent forecasters. I think it is fair to say that the economy has been growing more slowly than it would otherwise have done. After all, we've had the big fall in the pound, which has pushed up inflation and squeezed consumer spending power. We've had the uncertainty overhanging business investment, people obviously worried about a cliff edge or what the future relationship with the EU might be. So I think it's fair to say growth is a little bit weaker than it would otherwise have been. But those negatives may not in fact prove to be permanent. The currency is starting to recover a little bit of ground. And we mustn't, of course, forget the benefits that a more competitive currency brings to the wider economy. I also suspect that as the future relationship with the EU becomes less of a concern for businesses, then and investment will pick up again. Indeed, a lot of the impact on investment so far, I think, has been projects delayed rather than cancelled completely. A good bellwether here, by the way, is what's happening in the city. You may remember all those stories of tens or maybe even hundreds of thousands of job losses. In practice, those projections are already being scaled back day by day. And I think in future, the city will remain a very attractive place for companies to locate. It's got the critical mass that other financial centres across Europe don't have. So I'm pretty optimistic that we will continue to weather the Brexit shock well. Certainly the news of a transition period has been welcomed by businesses, and I think that's probably the right reaction. I think growth will continue to surprise on the upside this year. And over the medium to longer term, I think we'll look back and wonder what all the fuss about the economic impact of Brexit was about.
And do you think that some of the forecasts that have come out since the referendum have been accurate?
Well, I mean, maybe the most notorious example of this was the Whitehall Brexit economic impact analysis that was leaked in January and then finally published in March, which looked at three scenarios and, surprise, surprise, found that the UK economy would be worse off in all of them. If you actually read the study itself, it makes clear that it's only partial and incomplete analysis and that a lot more work needs to be done in certain areas. Indeed, I myself published a piece identifying no fewer than six gaps in the analysis, and the first of them was simply they didn't actually analyse what the government is aiming for in terms of a comprehensive free trade agreement with the rest of Europe and new streamlined customs arrangements. So that was only partial analysis. But funny enough, even if you did take the analysis at face value, it was essentially suggesting that growth might be a few percentage points lower over the next 15 years than it would otherwise have been, against a backdrop where the economy is likely to grow by between, say, 25, maybe even as much as 30%. So again, I don't want to dismiss the economic risks involved here, but I think it would be rather foolish to base your view on Brexit purely on that partial economic analysis of what might happen over a very long period, when we know a lot of the costs, but also the benefits of a Brexit are highly uncertain and very difficult to quantify anyway.
In terms of modelling, when you're trying to project and model the benefits of trade agreements and so forth, it's notoriously difficult to actually be able to do this. And in fact, the US International Trade Commission looked at the potential benefits of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which, let's remember, that's an agreement that there's already text, so they can actually look at an actual agreement. The British government can't look at any agreement because we haven't started negotiating with anyone yet. But even with the TPP, the ITC reported that it was phenomenally difficult to measure the benefits of reduction of behind-the-border barriers and market distortions. There have been many, many examples of massive misses by economic modellers, and most, I think, one of the biggest misses was the New Zealand government and the New Zealand Institute of Economic Research basically did a study on the potential benefits of the New Zealand-China free trade agreement and underestimated by about 500%. In fact, there were projections as to the export levels that New Zealand would reach with China within 20 years. Well, those were reached within 20 months. So it just is incredibly difficult to model this. And all of it depends on what your fundamental assumptions are. So as Julian said, if you assume that we will not change anything ourselves, if you assume we won't have a deal with the EU, if you assume that it won't deal with regulatory barriers, if you assume that our deal with the US, and if we have one, that it won't deal properly with behind the border barriers and regulatory distortions, which is where most of the barriers to UK services trade exist, then you'll get one set of results. If you make a different set of assumptions, you'll get radically different results. And one thing that is absolutely certain is there is no country in the world that determines its trade policy based on economic modelling of where different benefits can arise. But I will say that there have been various studies that have focused on the trade costs of divergence and the loss of free circulation that the customs union provides. And the most recent Clifford Chance study showed a cost of about £27 billion. So it is legitimate to say, well, let's assume that's a figure for trade costs of divergence and customs costs and frictions and so forth. And then what you have to think about is, well, if you execute independent trade policy, which means unilateral actions, bilateral actions, everything else that we talked about, what is the benefit of that? And in that context, I know 27 billion sounds like a big number. It isn't a very big number at all. And in that context, that's what people should be weighing.
Yeah. These models are only as good as the data that gets put into them. So the question of the Irish border has proven to be this huge sticking point. Mm. And the government provisionally seems to have agreed to the backstop solution of Ireland potentially remaining within the customs union if they can't agree on other aspects of the deal. What is happening here? It does seem, from the outside at least, to be something of a fudge, and it's pretty unclear what is meant by things like full alignment.
Mm. Yeah, so I think the way to look at the Irish border is to ask the question, what can we do to ensure that we are not hardening the Irish border in ways that damage the Good Friday Agreement and the peace process? And that is basically the charge that was given to governments as a result of this process. And I think there is actually a lot that you can do. And it starts off by understanding what the nature of the trade is between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. First of all, with respect to people, we've already agreed that the common travel area will continue to apply. The common travel area applied previous to our accession to the European Union. So for people, as long as the UK does not start imposing visa or requiring visas for tourists, and as long as the Republic of Ireland does not join the Schengen area, then the common travel area will take care of the movement of people issue. With respect to goods, where most of the issues are, the first thing we need to understand is that the majority of trade that the Republic of Ireland has with the world, so about 12% of the Republic of Ireland's total trade is with mainland GB, and about 1% or 2% is with Northern Ireland. And the same numbers replicate for Northern Ireland. So essentially what you are talking about is low-volume, high-frequency trade across the border. And that lends itself to looking at micro enterprises, which is a lot of the trade that goes on across the border, and giving them essentially a much, much freer ride in terms of operation of the customs frontier. And then with respect to the bigger businesses, and there are about 53 non-SME businesses that trade from Northern Ireland into the Republic of Ireland. So we are talking about a small number of businesses. That lends itself to a trusted trader program. It lends itself to a something that will end up looking to the trade more like filling in a VAT return than sort of clearing a customs border would conventionally, you know, look like. We can also move technical checks away from the border in most areas. We can use a lot of technology. There's a lot of technology on the US-Canada border. There's a lot of technology that's used between Australia and New Zealand. Many, many countries and many, many modern customs borders use significant technology in order to mitigate the hardening of that border. We could also do things like special economic zones in Northern Ireland. The UK will have the ability to do a special economic zone in Northern Ireland. We can invite the European Union to operate a special economic zone contiguously on the other side of the border in the border region. And, you know, if they choose not to do that, you know, I would argue they're not really complying with the agreements we have, that they'll, you know, we'll use creative thinking and so forth to try and solve this issue. There's no silver bullet for the Irish border, but there are a lot of different things that we can do. You know, we have a single electricity market. We already operate a single all-Ireland market for veterinary and meat products. We can continue to do that. Of course, as long as we are aligned in terms of regulatory goals and objectives, and we have recognition of underlying product regulation, we won't need those checks at the border. So trying to get mutual recognition and underlying product regulation is very important. And actually in meat trade, New Zealand EU already has underlying product regulatory recognition already. So there are precedents that we can rely on there as well.
Final question. It might sound a bit far-fetched, but since the decision, we've seen a concerted effort from a number of groups who are in one way or another trying to overturn the results of the referendum, including the Best for Britain campaign. And the most recent strategy seems to be to cast doubt on the results due to questions about Vote Leave spending practices. How seriously should we view these challenges?
Well, clearly there's a lot of political support amongst a minority of hardcore opponents of Brexit for a second referendum, or another referendum, as they prefer to put it. But I think the public as a whole, at least judging by the opinion polls, is saying, let's just get on with it. I think that's where we'll ultimately end up. But even putting the politics aside, I think there are three practical reasons why another referendum would be difficult. First is, of course, when would it take place? I mean, presumably it has to happen before we leave, so maybe in October. But what then are we voting on? Because we'll have an outline for the withdrawal agreement, but we won't know what the future trading relationship with the rest of Europe will be. And that's clearly a critical unknown. There's also the question of what the question would be. I mean, is it remain or leave? Well, we can't really do that again. We've asked that question already. Is it accept the deal or leave without a deal? Is it, you know, accept the deal or try and negotiate another one? I think there's a lot of uncertainties around what the question would be. And then finally, there's to me, the biggest problem as an economist, that it would complicate the bargaining process. If the EU knew that we're going to be having a referendum, for example, in October, I think they would offer us the worst possible deal in the hope that we would reject it and remain a member of the European Union. So it complicates the bargaining process. So regardless, if you like, of what you think about the politics, there are lots of practical reasons why I think another referendum wouldn't make sense. Parliament will have a vote on the terms of withdrawal, and I personally think that's sufficient.
And this point about the bargaining process is incredibly important. You talked about the backstop Ireland, you know, deal. You know, if the European Union thinks that they can get, as a backstop, an agreement for regulatory alignment with the UK through solving the Irish problem, there is no incentive for them to negotiate a free trade agreement with us at all, and the backstop will become a front forward position. So we've got to be very careful. We've got a track record so far in these negotiations of doing a lot of negotiating with ourselves. Europe has been much more disciplined, and I think we need to become equally disciplined going forward.
Absolutely. Thank you.
For more podcasts, blogs, reports and films, go to our website, iea.org.uk.